This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Listening to the Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, one of our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners all the way across the country and now into the United States as well. You could also be listening on Rabble.ca, our very appreciated local partners here in Toronto, or you could be listening on the podcast as well off our site, of course, of which if you are doing so, you can look forward to a brief bonus show at the end of the show. We have a really exciting topic, I think, for the bonus show as well today, but I will tease you about that later. I am, of course, your host, Darren Kaster. I'm sitting in studio with pretty much everybody this week. We've had a few people away. I have a full studio today. So Stefan Hostetter's back. He's going to be talking a little bit about his trip in just a minute, which was out to a conference, an environment conference over the last week as well. We're going to relate that to a bunch of news. We'll also be talking about Trudeau's visit to the U.S. We'll be talking about the Chippewa of the Thames Line 9 Challenge and relating that to a number of Indigenous struggles both in Canada and across the world with regards to the environment, and I bet you know how that's going to go, but we'll give you the details in a few minutes as well. And then I'm also very much looking forward to our guest this week. We have a guest, and if you've been listening regularly, you'll know that we've inverted our order, and we're actually doing our interviews last now. So at the very end of the show, we will be talking to Matthew Klippenstein, who is a chemical engineer and plug-in electric vehicle enthusiast. And the one thing I thought that was funny about that is that, you know, I say I'm an enthusiast about a lot of things, but when somebody who's a chemical engineer says they're an enthusiast about something, you know that they have a lot more detail than I would when I say I know I'm an enthusiast about something. So Matthew is, he wouldn't put it this way. I've spoken to him and I've looked at some of his work. I would cautiously call him possibly an expert on the subject. So we're looking very much forward to speaking to Matthew at the end of the program about the future and current reality of electric plug-in vehicles here in Canada as well later in the program. But without further ado, fresh off, I'm not going to call it vacation, but Stefan, back from a conference, Globe Conference. Do you want to start telling us a little bit about your experience?
Yeah, for sure. So this was an interesting time for me because I went, so the Globe, just so for everyone knows, the Globe 2016, it happens every 2 years. It's a conference, well, about corporate sustainability, basically, is their main mandate. And I went with, well, obviously, biases. And I went intentionally to sort of see, to sort of understand where they sat sort of with reality. You know, the main question I went in, I sort of was explaining this throughout the entire week I was there, was this question of whether or not corporate sustainability was like a bunch of people prettying up a cage and then wondering why they're still in it, you know, that was really my question. That was my honest question going in, and I wanted to actually challenge that and sort of see what people were there doing. And the first thing I need to say is that the first thing I came out coming out of this conference is that the people in corporate sustainability really do care. There are real people who really, really are trying to change the world, and they have the capacity to make massive, massive changes. You know, they're in the positions of power that actually are able to do so much, so much work. You know, like it or not, the corporate sustainability officer for a large oil and gas company can do one relatively small thing within their job, which reduces more carbon than you know I could possibly hope to in my lifetime, theoretically. Now, there's this tension. What I went into this conference was a tension between capacity and sort of the final solution, which is the wrong way to say that. But like the actual solution to climate change, basically.
Perhaps ultimate
solution. There we go. To actually breaking through this sort of difficulty we have. Darren is now laughing at me, which is fair. So that was the tension I sort of came in trying to understand. To use Globe's own words to how it builds itself, is that it calls itself North America's largest and longest-running conference and exposition series dedicated to business innovation for the planet, which is a bunch of words to try to say corporate sustainability without ever saying the words corporate or sustainability, which, you know, I guess it's in the prerogative to avoid those words. And so I sort of went through this, asking this question. And I came up with sort of four different points in this event that really left me with a sort of a distinct feeling about the whole experience, and then also how it tied back to one sort of shocking event that happened in the middle of it, in sort of the weird dichotomy I saw between where I was and this world event. And so the first thing is that it's important to note that Trudeau opened this conference. You know, the Prime Minister of Canada opened a sustainability conference and wasn't booed off stage, which is something you couldn't say for the past 10 years. And that alone, I think, deserves something. In his speech, he both said he pledged $75 million to green tech, and then also said that pipelines were going to pay for our energy transition. Which again, I think I titled this part Trudeau and the Elephants, because if there was one thing about this conference that I felt like, it was that there were these elephants in the room that no one was allowed to talk about throughout the entire 4 days I was there. And the first one was this idea that somehow they managed to talk about energy transition about 75, 80 times, and never once did they ever sort of imply that that also might mean that coal and natural gas and oil were on the way out? It was somehow that we'd have an energy transition, yet oil would still be fine?
I think if I might jump in just for a second, Trudeau's quote, "The choice between pipelines and wind turbines is a false one."
Right, exactly. Because build, baby, build. exactly. Like, and that sort of underlines a sort of this weird false dichotomy that this weird double speak, I guess, that sort of occurred the entire time. Yeah, Amy?
Stefan, I just wanted to ask sort of what you heard about this initiative called Sustainable Prosperity. This is something that was highlighted by various business people who've kind of been spokespeople for this kind of thinking, including Arlene Dickinson, who most people know from Dragon's Den. Was there any talk about sustainable prosperity? From what I heard, it was very much speaking to what you've just addressed, which is we've got to get our products to market, but we support carbon pricing, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so carbon pricing was big. It was fascinating. Everyone wanted a price on carbon. And every industry wanted a price on carbon. And there was actually even some decent talk about not only having price on carbon, but actual useful price on carbon, which is sort of pushing the economies forward. But to the extent in which I think price on carbon, in some ways, it was used as a magic bullet to then allow for the rest of unsustainable practices to carry forward. You know, it was like, as long as you have price on carbon and we're saying that, then the rest of it's okay. Like, so the head of Suncor sat down to directly say we need a price on carbon.
He also admitted that he thinks that fossil fuels are a contributor to climate change. News.
Yeah, no, exactly. I find it so funny about that him sitting down doing that is that it really is like this, hey, guess what, people? I'm saying things that everyone said 30 years ago, but for me, it's news. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Darren.
Coming up after the break, gravity exists.
Well, it's gravity for someone who invents moon shoes. But that was the first thing. So this is an interesting conversation about, like, the one time this actually got broken through, actually twice it got broken through. The first time was Amory Lovins had a talk. He has an amazing book out right now talking about the energy transition, and he has one quote, which was basically that oil companies have more to concern, should be worried more about market competition than they should climate regulation. And he, in about half an hour, he went through this perfect exposition of why oil prices will probably never go up and why it's on its way. And it was beautiful. If it is possible to find that online, I'm not 100% sure. I haven't checked out that yet. Please do so. So to move on, this one moment, I think, was the one that stands out, and I think it is perhaps the best way that ties into the sort of the carrying on thing. I have a whole bunch of thoughts. I'm going to write it up and I'll put it somewhere else and we'll share it. But this one, I think, ties in perfectly to where I want to go, which is I went to a session called Brand and Sustainability in the Age of Transparency, which was already a fascinating idea.
Yeah, can I – sorry to jump in.
Yeah.
I'm assuming they mean this upcoming age of transparency as opposed to something that we're in.
Well, they were referring really specifically to sort of the power of the internet to find you out, basically. No, it wasn't that...
Despite all attempts to the contrary.
Exactly. And actually, this to set the tone of how this talk went, it opened up with someone... They didn't say this exactly, but they said this... This is what they meant while not actually saying it, was that marketing is harder now than it was in the 70s, because if if you lie, people will find out. Was right. basically what he said without actually saying it in that those words. So basically the idea was it's like you. His point was that people will always find out if you're ruining the planet, and so you have to be honest about what you're doing because people will find out and they will ruin you.
Yeah, I think one day, Stefan, you remember from the Muppets?
Yes.
Yeah, those two old guys, they would sit in the rafters.
Yeah.
I think one day if we somehow imagine end up with a lot more resources than we currently have, aka any, that we should just go and like annotate conferences and we'll do like a live stream and just like constantly make sarcastic comments. I don't think it would help anyone learn anything, but.
Right.
It would amuse myself.
Yeah, exactly. And so around this time, I want to sort of show the dichotomy of these two things that happened around the same time, and sort of shows where I think sustainability needs to understand that price on carbon. To go back to your point, I made that price on carbon is not enough. Which was that here we were at a sustainability conference, and during this brand sustainability and age of transparency, there was a four person panel. All middle-aged white men. And one of them happened to be a representative for Nestle Water North. and he was just up there for an hour and a half talking literally about brand and sustainability in the age of transparency. And not a single question got to him about how the completely unsustainable practices and the horrendous record that Nestle has with water. And so it was just such an impressive display of what invisible power looks like.
Yeah,
if you ever wanted to show what invisible power looks like, put a man on stage to talk about Nestle Water North and branding for an hour and a half and never ask him a question.
Yeah, sorry to kind of make it. I just for the sake of the audience, in case there's anybody that isn't aware of this, I know I've said it a lot, but not everybody listens every week, even though you should, is that, this is the company that, it purchases water from municipal sources and then it bottles it and charges you 1,000% price uptick. And the CEO of which has said, and I never get tired of saying this, you do not have a human right to water. Water, which, lest I remind you, water is a physical requirement for life. There is no way to survive. Life cannot exist without water, which means that the official position of the CEO of Nestle is that no one on earth has a right to life. That's not a conjecture. I'm not stretching his point. Literally, his opinion is that nobody has a right to life. If you don't have money, you do not have a right to live.
Yes. To his obvious defense of this is that he thinks that if you put a price on all water, then everyone will not use it so much. But that's doesn't fly with me. So Nestle has this terrible record. But the point is that during the same time that this was happening over here, and we're in this conference where invisible power was perhaps so obvious in the things that you weren't allowed to talk to, things that you couldn't talk about. To the extent that by day three was the first time I heard anyone say the word carbon budget, and also in that same talk was the only time I heard anyone say that activists created the space to bring oil and gas and government to the table. And that was both from Sipora Berman, who was arguably the only activist in the entire thing, except for the indigenous peoples who were given two panels but not actually included in the rest of the actual conference. But
a theme, you might say,
a theme
in the show.
Yeah. So during, I think it was the same day, during this entire conference of the invisible power, I was following Twitter, and a tweet came up about Berta Cáceres, who was murdered, is an environmental activist in Honduras who was murdered. And when you say murdered, it was more of an assassination. Two people broke into her house and shot her. This wasn't a murder over anything else beyond her activism. And she had received death threats, and like there's a whole outcry about how Honduras failed to actually protect her. And I was sitting here in this sort of weird space where, like, here we're talking about carbon pricing is going to solve all the problems, yet ignoring the massive power that we are seeing of Blockadia and of these indigenous people actually rising up to fight the system in itself, and yet we're having this massive conference and not a single word on any of this can be mentioned. And the stark contrast between what was happening with the conference and then what was happening in Honduras or in all across the world where these different fights are happening in every – like all really – like the Blockadia exists almost everywhere now. And just a quick aside, Blockadia is a sort of – in this moment where civil people are coming up and using civil disobedience to stop different parts of different pipeline projects or other infrastructure projects that are harmful for the environment. And so I was just. It so effectively drove home for me this dichotomy and this separation that exists between what we see in corporate sustainability and what we actually need to get to with environmental justice first lens. I don't have an exact full answer to how we sort of bring these two together. And I think the real question that I have and the question I will leave with our listeners is really how you can take this one side of this power dynamic, which is so obvious and yet so does such a good job sort of hiding itself in plain sight to some extent, but has the capacity and honestly the will to some extent to actually really do a lot of good with the sort of complete other lens of environmental justice that has to be understood but exists within the same power system. You can't say that the people who run Shell in are doing great energy projects in Alberta and other stuff like that, and who are actually building wind turbines in Alberta, are the same people who are in Nigeria completely disregarding the laws. And MA.
Yes, I think this is such an important thing to highlight. And I just want to make a comment on that particular case that you've raised. One thing that it really makes clear also is the role of state actors in this dichotomy. So, for example, the Obama regime has wanted to be known for their legacy on climate and the environment. They also have supported this regime in Guatemala that actually has really attacked indigenous rights by furthering these kinds of dam projects. They've supported their military, they've supported their police, they've supported a regime that ousted a democratically elected government that came to power by coup. So you're seeing, again, right-hand, left-hand problems, if I can put it that way, which are then coming to a head when an activist loses her life. Of course, this is an alleged assassination. We don't know that for sure. But her struggle really highlights the struggles of indigenous people, which are happening every day around the world. And once we come back from the break, I also want to talk about the process around the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, where our indigenous peoples have made representations. And there were some findings about that this week.
I just want to really quickly say that there's an event in actually just under an hour, Justice for Berta Cáceres, outside our MP and Minister for Trade, Chrystia Freeland's office, to bring attention to Canadian investment and complicity in supporting these governments that Emma is mentioning and Canadian mining as well.
All right. So I think we should probably take our break there. We'll take our first music break. We'll be back with more news in a few minutes. And then as well, as I said, we're going to be talking about electric vehicles in Canada at the end of the program today. So you're listening to The Green Majority. Stay tuned to that dial. Please enjoy this music break. However, give you a chance to digest all that good information. And we're going to find out from Alex today. Alex is going to tell us what we're going to be listening to on this music break.
Thanks, Darren. So for the first music break today, we're going to check out a new song by Shotgun Jimmy. He's a great maritime artist, and he's released about 7 albums in the past 10 years, and he's just got a new one coming out, and this is the title track, I believe, from it, called Field of Trampolines. So here it is.
And we're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to get into a little bit more news in just 1 second, but before we actually throw to MA, we have, as we said, if you're listening on the podcast version that's found on our site, we have a brief bonus show, which is hosted by Sabina, and Sabina's just going to really quickly tease what this bonus show is going to be later in the program. So Sabina, go ahead.
Hi, thank you, Darren. So today on the podcast, we'll be discussing a new study at UBC, which observed that welfare recipients are seen as immoral for buying ethical products, whereas wealthier people are seen as virtuous. And we'll try to have a discussion on that.
All right. Thank you very much, Sabina. Looking forward to that in the bonus show. But without further ado, I'm going to hand it back to one of my co-hosts, M.A. Ma, who's going to lead us through the news in the second section. Take it away.
Thanks, Darren. So I just want to pick up on the theme of the right to water. Can't believe that is actually debatable, but apparently it is, especially if you're referring to some of the corporate folks at Nestle, apparently. Mm-hmm. And I just want to highlight something else that's been happening on a similar timeline to some of these international and Canadian climate discussions. Canada was under its 10-year review under the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. The committee or panel that looks at how countries are doing against their commitments provided some conclusions on this. And during this process, some of our First Nations made representations to the panel, and one of the huge findings that has been highlighted, and it's in one of the articles that is posted on the website today, is that many Indigenous communities, over 100, I believe, in Canada, do not have potable water. In this day and age, can you imagine that this is a gross human rights violation? So when we look at Indigenous struggles and we look at the relationship to water as a fundamental human right, the relationship to natural resources, and the ongoing struggles, this is just a really important thing that we wanted to acknowledge on the show, especially today's show, where we're highlighting the ongoing day-to-day struggle of Indigenous peoples.
Yeah, and so I just wanted to, I was going to sneak it into the last section, but we ran out of time, and I really don't want to spend too much time. I mean, I would love to, don't get me wrong, but it's just as far as today's program, I'm not going to take a bunch of time to talk about this, but there's one of the news stories that came up today was that as of, I believe, yesterday, at least within the last 48 hours, an Amazonian tribe kidnapped some Petroperú workers following a string of oil spills. And now you can read a lot about the story, please do. I'll put the link on the website. That's all I'll say about it for now, just because we have a lot of other stuff we also want to talk about. The reason I wanted to mention that and the point that I wanted to make was, you know, we can't divorce ourselves from this stuff. The oil that's coming there is being used not for, this isn't an internal Peruvian problem. This is oil being used for the global market, and these are international multinational corporations, the same ones that we talk about that want to be seen as fuzzy and friendly here in North America and in, you know, in Europe and all the sort of rich white nations. They get to do this, and we can't divorce ourselves from that. Not only can we not pretend like we have a global climate budget, we also have to remember that this is globalization. This is things. So when something happens and there's a bunch of oil spills and, you know, activists are murdered and there's tons and tons of oil spills where oil is being done, and we go, well, that's not in Canada. We're the good country. We get to wag our fingers at Peru. Hey, those are multinational, sometimes they call themselves Canadian, sometimes they call themselves Americans, but multinational corporations that are producing products for us to consume. And those people are being murdered, and these things, spills are being happened, and this land is being destroyed for us to be able to consume that product. And just because the CEO of Exxon didn't pull the trigger, and just because someone who maybe doesn't even directly work for one of these companies directly pulled the trigger, doesn't mean that this is not part of this entirely same thing. So we can't pretend like this is some other thing that's happening somewhere else that we have no connection to. It's just not.
It's interesting because I think what we are doing right now is pretending, you know, that Sarnia and the industry there is somewhere else and is not in Canada. Mm-hmm. I just returned from Sarnia for the first time I visited, was obviously incredibly struck by the industry there, and the fact that Omgenang First Nation sits like right in the center of it all. And so, you know, we've been talking a lot about water. Emma had just mentioned, you know, we met two women in Sarnia who have really literally been putting their bodies on the line for the health of that community. And Sarnia refines, I think it's 40% of all petroleum products in Canada. Like, it all flows down to Sarnia. So, and there's, you know, cancer medications being manufactured and produced using some of the like chemical refineries there. Like, it's really supplying our lifestyle, and it's in Canada. It's like right across from Detroit in Canada. So I had just returned from there, and also wanted to mention the Enbridge Line 9 Chippewa of the Thames Supreme Court case. So the appeal was approved basically to go to the Supreme Court, and we had talked about water. So Enbridge Line 9 crosses the Thames River in London, as well as 35 other rivers that flow into Lake Ontario. So although as we had David Donald Gray on a couple of weeks ago talking about how the flow of Line 9 has been reversed, like it was approved by the National Energy Board, the Chippewas of the Thames have a lawsuit basically going in against that. So we see again that First Nations resistance is really...
Yeah, that's such a critical lawsuit to point out, Brenna, because they had put this lawsuit forward. It was actually rejected by the federal court, and the ruling you're talking about came from the Supreme Court of Canada, which enables them to actually appeal the federal court ruling. And they're doing this on the basis that, you know, the duty to consult was not upheld. and the court has actually agreed with them. So the Chippewas of the Thames have pointed out that there's a long struggle ahead. This ruling just allows them to go forward with their appeal. It's not a final decision in itself. Mm-hmm. So I think this is something that everyone should be paying attention to. And those of you who do agree with and support this cause should really be lending your support to the Chippewas of the Thames. The other thing I wanted to highlight, because we promised to talk about it, and I almost feel a little bit strange doing so, given the, you know, the severity of the issues we've been talking about with regards to Indigenous peoples, but to completely go on off on a different track, is that there was a huge North American love-in this week between President Obama and Prime Minister Trudeau on Trudeau's first state visit to the U.S. That was the first... visit of a Canadian prime minister, I believe, in about 20 years. Why we're mentioning it on the show is that climate change did figure quite prominently in their discussions, and they actually came out with some fairly concrete commitments. So I'm just going to run through those very quickly for you, highlight a few of them. So one thing that the leaders did agree to do was reduce methane emissions from the oil and gas industry by 40 to 45% below 2012 levels by 2025, and also to pursue these commitments through the G20. They also said that they would look at the reduction of emissions from hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, as well as looking at emissions reductions for on-road heavy-duty vehicles, and also look at the aviation industry, emissions from the aviation industry. Can I just point out that I think they got more work done than the Prime Minister and the Premiers when they met in Vancouver? I mean, this is, you know, it's a different context, and one could say, well, Obama's an outgoing president and he wants to leave a legacy. But can I just point out that these guys actually released a target, and that is a lot better than what we've seen done between the provinces and the federal government so far. They made a hard commitment with a real reduction indicator in there, my goodness. And you know, the commentary on this piece was that, well, you know, these things don't just get announced when these guys meet, shake hands, and have a fancy state dinner. They're the work of a lot of negotiations that go in beforehand so that they can actually produce something substantial. Well, couldn't we apply that principle to the process that the premiers and the prime minister just undertook? Now, why didn't they bring these kinds of things to the table, knowing that we have to tackle these things and come out with something a little more concrete? Does anyone want to get in on that action? Darren, you look like you're wanting to jump in.
I wanted to point out that one of the most shared, one of the most popular, and one of the highest search result articles that comes up when you do that, not the highest, but up there enough to be noticeable, is actually the fact that, and I believe it was American, I could be wrong, it might have been Canadian, but I'm pretty sure it was American news outlet, decided to report on the fact that everyone was wearing clothes designed by a Canadian designer. The title of the article was actually, "Did You Know Canada Has Designers?" So it's good to know that the mainstream media is really all on top of this.
I'm going to jump in and to some extent defend the First Minister's meeting. Mostly because a couple of years ago, when I worked for a professor here at the University of Toronto, and really looked into what killed Kyoto. And really looked into sort of all the first minister's meetings that happened then. And arguably, I believe, I could be incorrect about this, but this is one of the first minister's meetings since all the talks around Kyoto died almost 15 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was the first one in 10 years. So I think it was probably 2006, right before Harper, right around when Harper came in. And while I share MA's sort of disdain for the lack of the amount of work to be done, I also just, from studying that, I know that what killed Kyoto to some extent was this demand to go faster, and was this demand to sort of get things done there was a very strong push by the Liberal government, because they knew they were probably losing power, to actually sort of ratify Kyoto out of it, and to talk about legacy as a legacy thing for Chrétien, and that is what pushed all of the provinces out of the conversation.
A fair comment.
And so so not to say, of course, that's it underlies the tension we still see, right, is that we need speed now, but also to get a lasting deal, you sort of have to give them some time.
Yeah, so it's not, for me, my criticism is not about working things out. So we do function in a federation. And so it's quite true that in terms of what actually gets done concretely, that does need to be an agreement between the provinces and the federal government. My criticism of the whole process is is the starting point. They need to start with a science-based platform. Mm. Even if they haven't agreed on how the details are going to be worked out, even if they're still debating that they may want to use different policy mechanisms to get there, they need to start with the basic scientific floor and say, okay, this is where we need to arrive at. Let us at least at a minimum agree with that. And then let's work backwards on customized plans for the provinces and areas where we're going to work across the board to achieve that. They're not taking that approach at all.
For sure. And I'm going to tee something up for Darren, because Darren half mentioned this, which is the difficulty there, of course, is if you want a pan-Canada approach, you have to get the – you're always limited by the – there's always a limiting factor, right? There's always the one premier who has the lowest bar that can put a wrench in the plans. And if they say no, then you don't have a Canadian plan. And the words coming out of Brad Wall's mouth right now what's fascinating is, like, you know, we finally have an Albertan government that's going to work on something, and then suddenly the Saskatchewan shows up and is like, but we're going to be jerks now. It's our turn.
All right. We're getting close to the end of the second section. I just wanted to sneak a few final things in. First of all, I keep forgetting we do actually have a phone number. So if you're listening to the show and you vehemently agree or disagree with something, we are very happy to play criticism or a range of views on the program. So you can actually have your say. We just can't do a call-in. So what we have is actually a message line. So it's listed on the Contact Us page on the website. But you can call 1-877-736-3921. If you didn't catch that, that's fine. Go to greenmajority.ca/contact us. You can call, leave us a brief message, and we'll be happy to play it on air, and then we can discuss it. It can be praise, it can be criticism. I would actually prefer criticism, frankly, because that's more interesting to me. But there's that as well. A couple other things really quickly as well is that we do also have a vote for the news thing every week. And the one thing that I actually most like to talk about, we got a few suggestions, and the one I was actually the most interested in came in at the last minute, so I don't have time to prepare for it. But there was two. One of them said that, you know, while we mentioned Leo, someone gave us the article from Mercy Franicle saying, now that Leo won the Oscars, it's time he watched his documentary. So fair point. We don't have time to talk about it, but I'm going to put the link on the website. So there's to acknowledge that. The other thing was a Business Financial Post article saying Canada may already be carbon neutral, so why are we keeping it a secret? And it's a giant pile of nonsense. Again, I don't have time to deconstruct it, but I'll give you one thing about how you can – now, if you're listening to the podcast – follow along, pause it in a second, and then you can do this yourself. I'm going to link to the article. The Financial Post doesn't – it lists where it gets the information from, but doesn't link to it. So I found the reference point, and the person saying is that Canada's carbon sinks are this, and therefore this and that, and makes all these comments about carbon. Here's the fastest way – there's a whole bunch of stuff that's wrong with this article, but here's the fastest thing you can do. If you actually go to the thing that the article is referencing as the entire data point for its entire argument, and you do Control-F or Command-F if you're on a Mac, now type in the word Canada – zero hits. There is no information in the entire research paper that specifically talks about Canada, meaning that you cannot make any conclusions about Canada. So at the very best, and I'm sorry, I've lost the note in front of me here. If I can find it really quickly, I'll tell you. It's not in front of me. This is a former minister. This is not some random person who's done a comment piece. This is a former elected official from Canada. So I'm going to do my best to actually come back to it, because I really liked how full of nonsense this was and how juvenile it was, especially from somebody with some accreditation to their name. But that's the best we could do, just because I got it in here at the last minute. And very quickly, I think we're right up. We got time for a final comment if someone wants to sneak something in before the break here.
I'll very quickly just – I want to talk about HFCs, because it ties back to this entire thing about trying to use the future or technology to solve all of our problems. Because this is my favorite story. I'll try to tell it in about a minute, which is that the way HFCs came into existence is that they were human ingenuity at its best. Because HFCs came into existence when CFCs were destroying the ozone layer. And we were like, you know what we should do? Change CFCs to HFCs. And then the American company got a patent for it. And so suddenly HFCs were what we use in coolant everywhere. And now, the fact that now they are a massive, massive, massive contributor to climate change, well, you know, specifically, they are really good at trapping heat in the atmosphere more so than they are actually – there's not as much of it as carbon, obviously. But the fact that sort of it was this human ingenuity at its best, like this idea like it's, we've solved the problem and now we're just now trying to find a third different thing to sort of get to it, sort of shows the difficulty of trying to actually solve a problem while still existing within the system that created it.
All right, so we'll have to leave it there on that topic as well. We're going to go and take our second and final music break. Just a reminder as well, if you're listening on something other than our podcast, you can get the extended version at greenmajority.ca as well. But we are being put out on a variety of community radio partners on rabble.ca, as well as live here at CIUT as well. All very appreciated partners to get the show out, and wanted to thank them very much for the opportunity to get this platform to talk about the show. And also to remind people again, yeah, if you want to reach out to us, contact us. You can send us an email. You can even leave a phone message that we could play on air if you'd like to have your say about any issue at all. Could be about a current topic or not. As well, make sure you can also send us suggestions for news articles and topics and whatnot. And that's a great way to get in touch as well. So that's it for my announcements for now. We're going to come back from the break in a minute and talk to Matthew Klippenstein, who's a chemical engineer, and he calls himself an enthusiast. I would say a borderline expert on the topic of plug-in electric vehicles. We're going to talk to him about electric vehicles in Canada. That will be coming up right after this music break in a minute. But now let's go to Alex again for our second and final music break.
Thanks, Darren. So this is a band called Minotaurs, and they're an Afrobeat band from Guelph. They're celebrating the release of a new album called Weird Waves today, and this is a single called Blind Luck. So let's check it out.
Right, welcome back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. Or you could be listening on one of our very appreciated community radio partners internationally now, as well as Rabble.ca, one of our other very appreciated local partners here. Or you could be listening on the podcast, which is also great, which you can find at greenmajority.ca. We're going to spend a little bit of time now on actually one of my favorite topics, and as Stefan knows, is actually one of my favorite topics ever, and we actually haven't talked about it in a really long time.
Yeah, it's true.
So I'm very happy to introduce Matthew Klippenstein, who's a chemical engineer and plug-in electric vehicle enthusiast. In his role with a leading renewable energy consultancy, he evaluates the wind energy potential of prospective wind farms. And as a veteran of the fuel cell industry, he co-authored Ballard Power Systems' white paper on the future of electricity for a McKinsey company essay series to which Stephen Chu and Andy Grove also contributed. The unofficial Canadian correspondent for greencarreport.com since 2013, Matthew also co-hosts the Clean Tech Talk podcast. A produced playwright, he's also contributed to two Canadian comic book anthologies. That is a hell of a read-in, Matthew. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I wasn't sure what to put, so I tried to cram absolutely everything in.
I hope you didn't miss anything, because then I would be even more in awe.
I once recorded a karaoke CD for my wife, who subsequently asked me never to buy her surprise presents again.
Nail in the coffin. I love it. So Matthew, you're here to talk to us today about, we may end up actually getting into a range of topics here, but we're going to start being on point, and then, you know, as is sort of the way of this show, we may ramble on off to something else at the end here, but we are limited for time. So let's jump in right into the intended topic, which is that you're going to give us you're going to start by giving us a little bit of a brief overview about where we actually are, just in sort of like 2 minutes, maybe, but where we are sort of with the EV plug-in vehicle in Canada, and then we're going to talk a little bit about why. So some of the things that have encouraged electronic vehicle, EV vehicle adoption in Canada, and maybe some of the things that are holding it back, where we could improve, and some of the reasons why we aren't even farther ahead than we could be right now. So without further ado, if you would kindly start by giving us a little bit of an understanding about where exactly we are with EV vehicles in Canada.
Sure. Right now we have probably a little bit less than 20,000 plug-in electric vehicles in Canada. That would be pure battery electric vehicles, whether it's the Nissan Leaf or like the Tesla Model S or Model X, as well as plug-in hybrids. These are things like the Chevy Volt or perhaps the Ford C-Max Energy, where you have in parallel a kind of a supersized battery as well as a full internal combustion system. As of now, from the stats that I've gathered, probably on the order of 18,000 vehicles sold in Canada so far, and that is still admittedly a drop in the bucket. It's like one in a thousand. The Canada's vehicular fleet is probably on the order of 20 million. And, of course, there are maybe the average car lasts maybe 20 years on the road, something of that sort. And so what we have right now is new sales are somewhere on the order of, say, 0.3%, 0.4% of new car sales in Canada, and there are a variety of reasons for that. Perhaps the biggest reason is that we might have a couple dozen models of electric vehicle in Canada, but they're mainly centered in the sedan. and we don't have very many crossovers, and the crossovers are at least in North America, seem to be the most popular vehicle segment. Not really any SUVs, no minivans. You have a couple little commuter car options like the Smart Electric Drive. But basically, the electric vehicles have for now been more expensive up front, and we haven't had as much consumer selection. There are also other issues we can get into, like ability for people to charge at home. But basically, on these kinds of technology adoption things, we're in the lower part of the S curve, where we're still kind of in the early adopters, and with the car industry being as big as it is, it will probably take a couple of decades really to really start seeing a massive a momentum shift.
So, Matthew, one of the first things I've been very interested to know, and I realize that part of this I'm going to be asking you for is opinion, and part of it relies on actual data, but to the best of your knowledge, what is your opinion on, just if we had to sort of categorize the reasons why people are not adopting? Do you think this is largely attributed to is it just, people like the idea, but they're just a little bit too expensive, and when maybe cost comes down, do you think maybe we haven't communicated well that, long term this will actually likely save you money? Where do you think people are getting stuck on this issue?
Sure. I think the most authoritative work actually around the world has been done by a team at Simon Fraser University here in BC. And what they did is they surveyed drivers from about 2013 new car buyers. And about a third of them had said that they were open to the idea of buying a plug-in electric vehicle. So that's good. I'm sure the number is higher now with more public awareness and so on and so forth. Then subsequently, that number of 30-ish percent dropped a bit below 20% because not everyone had the ability to charge at home. A lot of us, ourselves included, live in apartments or condos or townhouses where everyone shares a garage, and sometimes you have to... You're not sure if you can convince a landlord or the strata to allow you to plug in or install infrastructure. And subsequent to that, the cost is for now a little bit higher up front than with your typical combustion vehicle. That's not a knock against battery electric vehicles because, frankly, the combustion engine has been around for 100 years. It's produced by the billions each year, and so you'd expect that it's about as cheap as it's ever going to get. Whereas batteries still have a lot of opportunity to come down in cost. And then, as I was mentioning earlier, not every type of vehicle is available. And then you go from basically 30% to less than 1% market share because you have these constraints, and then people are willing, perhaps, to consider the idea, but then there has to be work done from advocates like myself and from the Green Majority audience and so on and so forth. To make sure that when people decide to spend a chunk of money on a new car, that those people who are in that fortunate of a position have all the information they need to be able to say, hey, I'm gonna evolve my consumer dollar choice.
So, Matthew, one of the most interesting notes, you sent me a whole bunch of notes, and we're not going to get anywhere near all of it. A ton of information you sent, but I am going to post it all in the show post. So if people are really interested in this topic, there will be just an absolute week's worth of homework worth of stuff on the website here on the show post you can find afterwards. But one of the things that interested me the most we were talking about was a pair of pieces you wrote analyzing what happened to EV sales in British Columbia when incentives were removed and then returned. If you can maybe outline that for us.
Sure. So what happened in BC, and I think it's pretty much the only place in the world where we had an incentive, we had a $5,000 rebate, up to $5,000, for the purchase of plug-in electric vehicles. The funding for that ran out in about 2014, and then a year later, funding was restored. So we had this perfect ABA situation where we had incentives. Then suddenly the price of every electric vehicle went up to the consumer by $5,000 because there was no rebate. And then again, it dropped back down $5,000. And then what we saw when we were comparing sales in BC versus Ontario and Quebec was that the proportion of sales, the relative percentage of sales in BC relative to the two other provinces dropped by about half for the Leaf and the Volt. These are the two sort of workhorse, the biggest selling, you could say, middle class or typical vehicles for the 99%, whereas sales for the Tesla were unaffected. And that may indicate that, you know, well, first, to Tesla's credit, they've made an amazing vehicle that, you know, people with the money definitely want to buy. But it also means that the presence of incentives for luxury vehicles like the Tesla or perhaps the BMW i3 aren't really effectively used because people buy them anyway. And I'm sure it's just a coincidence. I can't claim any credit, but in the past month or two, when Ontario and BC have revised their incentive programs, they kind of put a cap or reduced the amount of incentives you can receive for luxury vehicles. So it was basically the case that luxury electric vehicles do perfectly fine on their own, and the battery costs clearly aren't quite cheap enough it's basically having the small incentive or modest incentive does help to increase the market share, gives us the growth, gives us the volume of battery production, which drives down costs, which facilitates our transition to electrified transportation.
So one of the other links you sent, of course, was noting some recently bolstered EV credits for Ontario. And what I was hoping you'd do is do a little bit of compare and contrast there, but also to sort of roll that into some recommendations. Obviously, you've done a lot of analysis about this, and many of the reports you've written are sort of reporting, you know, what is happening. And I was just hoping that you'd be able to maybe make some recommendations. What do you think we could do either at a federal or provincial level to really help this along? How can we encourage this this adoption faster?
Okay, so the biggest lever that could be pulled would be a zero emission vehicle mandate, or a ZEV mandate. That's what they have in California. If you're a car maker and you want to sell in California, a certain percentage of your vehicles have to be zero emission, which basically means electric. You know, maybe one day we'll mean fuel cells, you have to have you have to make those vehicles, or you have to buy credits from other companies who sell an excess proportion of their sales. That is the gold standard of effecting change in the personal automobile sector. You know, admittedly, I use public transit every day. I'd love to have more public transit funding, but for private vehicle sales, that is the gold standard. It would be incredibly difficult for Ontario to implement that, though, because there are something like 8 automotive assembly plants, and any government which goes up against the auto industry that confrontationally would likely be defeated in a subsequent election. Now, the very promising thing is that Quebec has promised to mandate to have a ZEV mandate by the time the current government finishes its term, and Quebec is in an excellent position to do so because it doesn't really have any final automotive assembly plants. It is, you know, modestly sized market, maybe I think eight odd million people population wise, and you'd be able to affect that change. They also have a lot of adoption of electric vehicles. They're maybe a third of the Canadian population, but they're about half of the electric vehicle sales in Canada. Barring a ZEV mandate, having these incentives for the middle class buyer to tide us over to that era coming soon, where there's no real price premium, no substantial price premium between a battery electric vehicle and a regular combustion vehicle, that's probably the next best bet.
Right, and so we're unfortunately running tight on time. We just have time for one more thing, and what I'd actually, it's sort of a question, but I'm going to make a brief comment, and I'd like you to either agree or disagree with it. It's something that, to the best of my ability, I think is true, and I'd like you to, as the actual expert, to tell me if I'm on base here or not.
Sure.
Which is that one of the things I hear all the time, one of the biggest criticisms I hear all the time from people that are not enthused, let's say, that includes not enthusiastic all the way down to against electric vehicles, is one of the most common things I hear is, well, they're only as clean as the energy you put into them. But as far as I'm concerned, that's the best argument for them. That means that as soon as we get everything electrified, we can, as we're cleaning our electricity grid, which we're going to have to be doing anyway, that means that they can only go better, as opposed to, you know, gas vehicles, which are, you know, there's so much more room for improvement. And do you think that's a valid sort of response? Am I totally off base? What do you think of that argument?
I think your response is quite correct. I think the argument, that argument against, is a bit like maybe looking at the first computers, where they're like thousands of dollars, and or you couldn't search the internet before Google very effectively. You know, my uncle would say, you know, it's the only library where I have to go through a trash can to get to the book I want. So the electric grid in Canada in particular is very clean. Ontario's grid intensity is something on the order of 100 grams per kilowatt hour. That's fantastic. You definitely have emissions reductions within a few years of driving the plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. So after you do spend a bit more energy and emissions making the battery, but you recover that and you start net saving on emissions after a few years of driving. So the people who are raising this objection, they're kind of they're fighting a past war. You know, it sounds like it's convincing, but when you look at the reality, the trend, it's the wrong argument. It's like saying, oh, the iPhone's not going to succeed because it doesn't have a thumbboard keyboard. It's invalid. Might sound convincing, but it's just not a factor.
It always struck me as an argument that a corollary might be, don't eat meals because meals are only as good as the ingredients you put in them. Like, great, yeah, so let's use good ingredients. Like, I don't understand. That seems to me like just a goofy argument. I don't understand why anyone's really convinced by that. But anyway, unfortunately, we are running right up against the end of the program. Matthew, I could easily talk to you for another 2 hours. Maybe we'll have you back on again in the near future. We can spend a bit more time on it. But for now, I'm going to post many of the links that you sent me on today's show post. So if people are interested in this topic, check out today's show post, and please do go check out greencarreports.com and look for Matthew Klippenstein as well. Very knowledgeable, and we're very grateful for having you on the program today.
Yeah, I'm grateful for the opportunity to chat.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So again, that was Matthew Klippenstein from, among other things, greencarreports.com. So that is all the time we have for today's show, unless you're listening on the Green Majority podcast version, in which we'll be right back at the bonus show to talk about, is it ethical for people on welfare to spend money on ethical products? So other than that, thank you folks for listening to the Green Majority here on CIUT and all of our wonderful partners. Have a good green week, and we'll talk to you real soon.